I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. We begin today with a conversation about the travel ban ordered by President Trump Friday afternoon. Dr. Niloufar Hariri is a scholar and the director of the program in Islamic Studies at Johns Hopkins University. She joins me to talk about what the ban means. Then, Maryland's cash bail system. Some Maryland lawmakers are advocating for cash bail alternatives, while others want to do away with the system altogether. WIPR's State House reporter Rachel Bay on several criminal justice reform proposals that are in the General Assembly pipeline. Plus, Doug Colbert of the University of Maryland Law School joins us to talk about a program that's making it easier for people with failure to appear warrants to square up with the law by offering a second chance if they've missed their court date. Midday starts right after the news. And welcome to Midday, everybody. Glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. Some sound from BWI Thurgood Marshall Airport last night. Coming up in a little bit, we're going to turn our attention to criminal justice issues. A program at the University of Maryland Law School helps people who have received arrest warrants because they fail to appear at a trial. We'll also talk about efforts in the Maryland General Assembly to reform the cash bail system. But first, a look at the impact of the travel ban ordered by President Trump on Friday afternoon. The president has blocked visitors from seven predominantly Muslim countries: Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. The initial ban even included those who hold green cards. After a night and day of chaotic events at airports around the world, those holding green cards were allowed to re-enter the U.S. The order also treats refugees harshly. There is an 120-day ban on refugees from anywhere in the world and an indefinite ban on refugees from Syria, even those who've been in a years-long vetting process and who've been sponsors, or who have sponsors, in the U.S., willing and waiting to take them in and help them out. In his executive order, the president proclaimed that, quote, "the entry of nationals of Syria as refugees is detrimental to the interests of the United States." Many people couldn't disagree more. Thousands rallied against the executive order at BWI and at airports around the country. We're going to begin talking today with a scholar at Johns Hopkins who travels frequently between the U.S. and Iran. Dr. Niloufar Hariri is an American citizen of Iranian descent. She's an anthropologist and a linguist on the faculty of Johns Hopkins University, and she also directs the program in Islamic Studies at Hopkins. Niloufar, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So when you heard about this executive order, what was your reaction?
Well, I had several different reactions. One of them is basically being very afraid of the potential sectarian consequences of this, because there is a lot of language coming out of the White House pitting Muslims against Christians. And to address that, I would like to see if it's okay for me to begin with some personal background about myself and my growing up
Absolutely.
In Iran.
Yeah.
Because I just have a feeling that there is, on the one hand, a certain cartoonish image of Muslims that has no depth, and on the other, there's just historical and cultural lack of knowledge. I went to high school in Boston, actually, and I've been teaching at JHU for several decades, and my son was born in Baltimore, but I grew up in Iran, and I grew up in an Armenian majority neighborhood in Tehran, where I mostly heard Armenian. We went to Armenian delis because they had the best sandwiches. We went to Armenian hair salons, to Armenian churches to light candles. And as children, we watched Eastern celebrations and helped paint eggs. So what I want to say is that Christian communities in the Middle East are centuries old, actually older than Christian communities in the U.S.
By a lot.
And, you know, there is this impression sometimes in the media, or actually in rhetoric, political rhetoric, as though Christianity was born in the Northeast Corridor of the United States. But it wasn't. It was born in the Middle East. And we in the Middle East have grown up with Jews, with Christians, and Muslims for centuries. So it's very important to keep that in mind when we think about who are Muslims, who are Christians, and to realize that actually, you know, we've been living together for quite some time.
It's difficult for, I think, Americans who are American nationals with no background in any foreign country to understand the sort of the personal pain that this executive order has caused. For example, you do go back and forth to Iran to visit family and to do research and to do things. You take your young son, who's what, 11 years old, born in Baltimore. What's your next trip? When were you planning your next trip? And has this executive order, you hold an American passport. I mean, this right. shouldn't include you, but does it give you pause?
It does give me pause. I've been planning on going in March for my mother's memorial, who passed away in 2009. And it's also our new year, and I was planning to go. But at the moment, it is giving me pause. And in fact, my son told me, if we do go to Iran next time, will we be allowed to come back to the U.S.? He feels very attached to Baltimore because he was born here, and he does not want to be deprived of that. But he is clearly worried, as we all are.
What do you think the effect on domestic politics in Iran will be? President Rouhani, known as a moderate, what will this affect on, what will be the effect of his, you know, public popularity? Will this be a boon to the hardliners with right. whom he's opposed? How do you think that's going to play out?
Yes, that's a very good question. You see, on the whole, Iranians are very baffled by this executive order. Because not a single terrorist act has taken place on American soil that has involved Iranian citizens. Not one. And yet...
Not one actually from any of the seven countries.
From any of the seven countries, absolutely. And yet they are being included. And largely the population in Iran is quite young. They are hip. They are, you know... very familiar with the West, some things they like, some things they don't like. They like to be able to come and go. And so they are quite worried and upset. And insofar as Rouhani's government is concerned, yes, actually, what will happen is that this will play into the hands of the hardliners in Iran, who have always said that the U.S. has malevolent intentions towards Iran. It doesn't like Iranians. They hate Iranians. They hate Muslims. And here's the proof.
When the nuclear deal with Iran was being negotiated, the sanctions that were in place in Iran, I mean, there were things like medicines for children, you know,
yes.
that weren't available, cancer medications and stuff that no one could get for quite a period of time. I guess one of the unintended consequences at that period, during that period, was that the hardliners actually gained strength, did they not?
Tremendously. Because, you see, the only people who could get around the sanctions, who had the infrastructural wherewithal to get around sanctions, were the most hardline people who were supported by the military groups. And so they actually became far more powerful, and their role increased tenfold after the sanctions than before.
I guess it comes down to a judgment about efficacy, a judgment about whether or not this is a good way, as the president suggests, to keep America safe.
Yes.
What's your notion of this strategy and its effectiveness?
Well, I do agree with the president and everyone else who would like to keep America safe. There's no doubt that we all want that. The question is how to go about doing that. And it is clear to me, not just based on my own reading, but also reading many different lawyers, including reading a statement by Senators McCain and Lindsey Graham, that this is not the way to go about it. There are thousands and thousands of Muslims who have very ordinary lives, who live in this country, who come to educate themselves, become all kinds of, you know, actors, doctors, lawyers, and so on. And what is happening is that it is these people who are being punished. And it seems to me that the lack of success with getting rid of ISIS and the Taliban has basically translated into saying, okay, well, if we can't get them, let's just get any old Muslim. And this logic is very similar to ISIS. ISIS says, just kill any Christian. Take this bus and just run over as many people as you can. Well, in, you know, those people, there are all kinds of Christians. There are Muslims, there are Jews, there are Buddhists, there, but they don't care. So this is a very, very similar logic.
Niloufar Hariri is a professor of anthropology and linguistics at Johns Hopkins University. She runs the program in Islamic studies there. We got to finish up in just a couple of minutes here, Niloufar. There was a statement issued by the American or the Association of American Universities saying that this ban is already causing damage and should end as quickly as possible.
Yes.
In terms of scholarship, academic research, the free flow of ideas between the United States and the rest of the world. You're a scholar. You've been at this business a long time. What's your take on how that's going to play out?
Well, for example, let's take some of our students. They have applied for fellowships to go do research in Iran. Some of them have received fellowships. They cannot go because if they do, they will lose the validity of their visa will just go out the window. And we have lots and lots of computer scientists, doctors, actors, actresses, whoever. They cannot come to this country for the time being. And within academia, in fact, many, many, many thousands of students and faculty will be affected.
Niloufar Hariri from Johns Hopkins University, thank you very much for sharing your reflections here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Before we take a little break, let me turn now to Rachel Bay. She's the State House reporter here at WIPR. But last night, you spent the evening at BWI Thurgood Marshall Airport. Big demonstration there, Rachel. What did you see?
Well, it was a large crowd, about 2,000 people, according to the organizer. And it was really an atmosphere of, I would say, unity. It was really remarkable, actually. There were, by the accounts from the police, there were no arrests, no accounts of violence, lots of support for one another, and lots of diversity, some families with young children, people of all sorts of races and religions.
And this happened really quite spontaneously, not just at BWI, but at Dulles and at Kennedy Airport in New York and at airports all around the country. I mean, this, unlike the Women's March the week before, which had been planned for some time, this seemed to be pretty spontaneous.
Yeah, I believe this one at BWI was planned at some point on Saturday. It came together on Facebook and really very quickly gained a lot of traction. You saw in a matter of hours, the RSVPs on Facebook went from, you know, 100 or a couple hundred to well over 1,000. And it was, you know, a lot of people feel a very personal stake in this ban for one reason or another, and they were trying to, as one person told me last night, she just couldn't spend last night sitting on her couch. She had to be there.
Number of political leaders, both at the state and federal level, showed up and made remarks. Who was there?
So there were a few members of the congressional delegation. I spoke with Congressman Jamie Raskin. Elijah Cummings was also there, as was, I believe, Dutch Ruppersberger. And
Congressman Sarbanes was there as well.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see him, but I heard he was there as well. And former Governor Martin O'Malley also showed up, and there were a number of state legislators there as well.
All right. Well, we will, of course, continue to keep an eye on this, on the progress of this. It's already, you know, as we saw with the green card thing, a little bit of it got walked back within 24 hours, and who knows, there are a number of court proceedings now underway. Some people think that the president has a pretty strong hand in this particular argument, given the powers that he does have under the Constitution. So we will keep an eye on it. Rachel Bay, thank you so much. And you're going to be back with us in just a bit. We're going to talk about relief for people who've been issued a failure to appear warrant. And we're also going to look at some of the efforts in the Maryland legislature to reform the cash bail system. Again, our thanks to Dr. Niloufar Hariri. She's an anthropologist and linguist on the faculty of Johns Hopkins University, where she directs the program program in Islamic studies. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. Now a conversation about criminal justice reforms and a program to help people who have been issued warrants for failing to appear at court proceedings. Professor Doug Culbert and his students at the University of Maryland Law School have been running a special program this month that gives people with failure to appear bench warrants a second chance. Doug, welcome to Midday. Good to see you.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
There are also several bills in the pipeline in the General Assembly that aim to reform the state's criminal justice system. Governor Larry Hogan has proposed a bill that will, among other things, allow prosecutors to admit evidence of a defendant's prior record of sexual assaults. Other legislators have taken aim at the juvenile system by trying to raise the minimum age that a minor can be detained in a secure facility. And there are also several bills that address the state's cash bail system. Advocates of reform say that nonviolent offenders shouldn't have to languish in jail for weeks waiting for a court date simply because they cannot pay. Back in October, Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch sent a letter to the House of Delegates telling them that the state must consider a defendant's financial situation before setting bail, adding that people should not be imprisoned simply for being poor. In a letter to the House of Delegates, he said that this practice was likely unconstitutional. Those opposed to reform believe that doing away with the cash bail system will undermine the court's ability to get people to show up for their hearings and their trials. But there appears to be some significant support for reform. There isn't, however, at the moment, consensus on how that reform should look. Several Maryland lawmakers have come forward with bills that in different ways aim to change the current bail system. Rachel Bay joins us again here in Studio A. She's WIPR's State House reporter, and we'll get an update on some of these bills. Thank you, Rachel. Appreciate it. You are welcome to join our conversation here. 410-662-8780 is the number to call on Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Doug Culbert, let's start first with this failure to appear warrant project that you've got going. What is a failure to appear warrant?
Well, Tom, most people make their court appearances. They go to court on the scheduled dates. In fact, we have about 93-94% of the people in Baltimore. They go to court when they're supposed to. But there's a small group that's unable to get to court. And that could be because they're afraid of losing their job. They have school responsibilities, child care. They're sick. And for most of these folks, they live in fear 24/7 of being arrested, because when you miss your court appearance and you don't have a lawyer to explain to the judge why you're not able to be in court, that what happens next is that the court issues an arrest warrant, an FTA, failure to appear warrant. And so we have several thousands of people in our city who literally cannot leave their home without worry that they're going to be stopped or racially profiled, or in other ways, the knock on the door comes and they're worried that it could be a police officer. And what the law students have done in our Access to Justice Clinic is that they have addressed this problem, which has been with us for as long as anyone can remember. And with the collaboration of the judges and the police and the state's attorney's office and the public defender, we have been giving people a second chance since January 9th to come forward and just speak to their lawyer. They don't have to appear before a judge. In fact, we still have one more day tomorrow. So anyone listening who knows anyone who has one of these FTA warrants, tell them to take advantage. Just go down to a courthouse, see a public defender, get the advice of counsel. And if you're eligible, then the state's attorney will review and will recommend recall of the warrant. Eventually, it goes to a judge.
So for the last few weeks, this program started on January 9th. There's been kind of an amnesty program. You go in, you talk to a public defender, and in many cases, most cases, they're able to dismiss this warrant?
Well, but they get rid of the warrant. That's correct. But they people still have to come back and deal with their underlying misdemeanor case. And I should point out that we're talking here about the 92% roughly of arrests that are nonviolent misdemeanors. So we're looking at that group of people, and we're saying, and the police and the prosecution are as avid about this as the public defender. People would like to devote the limited resources to the more serious crime. Taxpayers pay a very high cost for incarceration.
About how many people does this affect? How many FTAs, the failure to appear warrants, are there out there now?
Well, the estimate is about 7,000 to 8,000 FTA warrants, and it's very hard to know the exact number. So what we've been doing, the students and I, is we've been going out into the community. We've been going, I've been going to church, Tom, more frequently in the last month than probably in my whole life. And I've been also going out to homeless shelters, to treatment programs. The city council provided an opportunity. So we've been really going around and trying to spread the word, but it's a tough go.
Most of these defendants are poor, and when they are under the cloud of an FTA, of a failure to appear warrant, it really does affect everything they're doing. It affects their ability to perhaps get a job. It affects their ability if they're on food stamps or get any sort of public assistance. It's difficult for them to get that because they're afraid that when they go and register with something or put down their name and address, they're going to be found.
Well, that's exactly right. This is another instance of there being two Baltimores. If Tom Hall missed his court appearance and asked me to represent him, I would have gone before the judge. You might have been homesick that day, and I will explain the circumstances. I'll contact the prosecuting attorney. I'll get you a new date. And even if for some reason you got picked up, you would have the bail money to get out of jail. For low-income working people and poor people, it's a very different story. They will stay in jail for at least 30 days. And that's where half of the pretrial population right now in Baltimore City, we have about 2,200 people. Half of them are in on FTA warrants. So this is a win-win situation, and that's why all the principal players have supported the program.
How long is there a typical length of stay pre-trial in jail because you've got a failure to appear warrant and you've been picked up and you don't have the money to make bail? We're going to be talking about bail in just a minute. But you know, are there people in jail for a matter of days? Is it weeks, months? How long is it?
It's an average of about 45 days that people are in jail on these misdemeanor warrants. And for some people,
and these are nonviolent crimes we're talking about.
Exactly. That's the only focus we're doing right now. And perhaps if the program's successful, it may extend. But right now, we're looking at the fact that the taxpayer is paying close to $150 a day to keep people in jail. And in most of the time, Tom, the cases are not prosecuted. Prosecutors prosecute about 2 out of 5 cases to get convictions. So it's very wasteful. It's inefficient. But perhaps most importantly, it just adds to the distrust and the poor relationship that exists between community and law enforcement. I think it's one of the main reasons why Commissioner Kevin Davis and State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby are enthusiastic supporters of this. They are hoping to build a better relationship with community.
And one of the points that Commissioner Davis makes is that this distracts when the police have to deliver these warrants. Sometimes they're even dangerous situations. I mean, rarely, but sometimes. But even if they're not dangerous situations, it's distracting them from doing the other kinds of police work that they could be doing.
Well, and you could just imagine you're sitting down for dinner, the knock comes on the door, or you see somebody in a restaurant and they have a misdemeanor warrant. Nobody wants to go off to jail. So if we provide an alternative, now, of course, the biggest issue to overcome here, Tom, is the distrust that's accumulated over many, many decades. So people still can't believe that this is for real. Many people have already put out the word, don't trust this. This is a scam. It's a sting operation. And so we're not going to overcome the distrust that's been there for a while, but we've made a very good start here. And if the program can be renewed and if the community can see how many people did come forward and did get their warrants taken away, that will lead to more people taking advantage in the future.
So this has been going on for about 3 weeks. About how many people have you had warrants cleared for?
Well, we don't know that because it's the public defender that has been devoting its limited resources, and really they deserve enormous credit for this because they are interviewing people. They're finding out about eligibility. Then they send over that motion over to the state's attorney. They review it. If everything looks fine, meaning you don't have any other serious problem in your past, then it goes over to the judge, and within about a 2-week period, the person's notified by their lawyer, you got a new date, come back, you don't have to live in fear of being arrested.
But you don't know how many people that involves at the moment. They're not sharing that information with you.
No, and I really would like to follow the cases through to the conclusion. One of the reasons that I think it'll be easier to bring people in for the next time I'm here, Tom, will be once people's cases are concluded, they don't have to worry that by going on a talk show, for instance, that they're going to draw undue attention to their own circumstances.
Right. We did try to find a person who was, you know, participating in your program, and we just couldn't find anybody who was willing to take that risk.
Well, people are willing, but their lawyers are saying, with caution, why don't you wait till your case is over? You don't want to really do this right now, and hopefully we'll have another opportunity.
Professor Doug Colbert from the Access to Justice Clinic at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. It's midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. You're welcome to join our conversation about failure to appear warrants and cash bail and other things related to criminal justice. Our phone number here, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Doug, I guess the one last question I want to ask you about this, you've outlined the various reasons that people, including people in law enforcement, support this sort of amnesty program, but others are going to say, well, look, they've been accused of a crime. Sure, it's a misdemeanor, but it's a crime, and a crime is a crime. You're given a court date. The court docket is very crowded. There's, you know, judges are under great pressure to dispense with all these cases. The prosecutors, the public defenders are under great pressure, and then they just don't show up. I mean, that's their problem, and if you don't show up, there should be consequences for that. Well, how do you respond to that?
Well, you sound like Judge Hardnose when you describe it like that, but usually the more compassionate judges and others will understand that there are reasons why people cannot make it to court. And most of our judiciary is fully behind this because they want to give folks the opportunity of getting back in the system. The goal here is to encourage people to take accountability for their charges, not to just stay on the lam, and it's not good for our justice system. So if you're a crime victim, you want the defendant to come back in because you want to get whatever compensation or vindication that's available. And that's why I think the goal here, let people come back in the system, deal with your charge, your misdemeanor. If they want to prosecute you, they have the right to do that. But we don't want to continue to have this backlog of people who are outside the system.
Yeah, it's several thousand of them, according to most estimates. And of course, at the core of this, Rachel Bay, our Annapolis correspondent here at WIPR, is this system of cash bail. You're in jail because you can't afford to get out of jail. You can't afford to pay a bail bondsman or bondswoman, sometimes, you know, many thousands of dollars to be released. Back in 2014, the Commission to Reform Maryland's Pretrial System issued a report that estimated between 7,000 and 7,500 defendants are in jail awaiting trial on any given day. There seems to be some action in Annapolis to address this problem.
Yes, there are quite a few bills potentially on the way. They haven't actually been introduced yet, but there's generally a consensus among the legislators who deal with judicial and criminal justice issues in Annapolis, that the bail system needs reform. The question is really just how far do you go and what does that reform look like?
I guess the question at the center of all of this is, you know, should a person's financial situation be taken into account when determining bail? I mean, if you've got a wealthy defendant, you know, perhaps that bail is set higher than if you've got a person who's indigent. Is that what they're talking about?
Right. And that is a big component of it. So there are a couple of ways that they're trying to deal with that. So there's one proposal, for example, that would eliminate the possibility of requiring cash bail for defendants who have been charged with nonviolent misdemeanor crimes. There's another proposal that goes a little further and eliminates cash bail entirely and would refer defendants to the pretrial system in whatever jurisdiction the defendant is in. So, for example, that could mean that instead of getting a cash bail, they at the high end, they could be under house arrest. They could have an ankle monitor. At the low end, they could have a weekly phone call check-in with someone from the pretrial services department and a monthly random drug test, something of that nature. So there's kind of a wide array of possibilities as alternatives to bail. And I think the point that the Attorney General has made is to remember that bail is not meant to be a tool to keep violent people from being released. If someone is actually deemed to be a threat to public safety, that the judge should say, no, I won't set bail. You will have to remain in detention while waiting trial. Bail is really meant to be a reminder and a motivation for people to show up to court. So if you can find other ways to remind people or motivate people that maybe are more fair to their specific circumstances, then that serve the same purpose, then that's kind of the argument for reform.
And Doug Colbert, bail is a fairly arbitrary thing, is it not? I mean, every judge has the authority and the capability of sort of deciding on his or her own what a reasonable bail is for people. I know there was a lot of discussion when the uprising and riots took place in April of 2015. Some people were, you know, put in jail with enormous bail amounts, and others, including some of the police officers who were arrested in that case, lower bail amounts. I mean, has there ever been a time when there's any sort of uniformity in terms of assessing what a bail amount should be for defendants?
Well, I think we have a real change this past week, Tom, and I think Rachel's report that she gave last week about Common Cause, and they released some really valuable information to explain why our battle to try and change the money bail system over the last 19 years has always been blocked in one of the two judiciary committees. And Common Cause came out with a report that showed that bail bondsmen and the insurance companies, they work hand in glove, the two of them, that they rank number 3 in the country in terms of how much money they receive, legislators receive from the bail industry. And two of the chairs, Senator Zirkin and Chairman Joe Valerio, they were number 2 and 3 in the country in terms of how much money they're getting. Senator Zirkin's only been chair the last 3 sessions. Delegate Valerio has been there for a very, very long time. So what we're learning now is how much money can gain the legislative support, the votes that are needed to block reform. We've had so many, every player in the system has been in favor of reform at different times. In fact, your 2014 Governor's Commission report on pretrial justice recommended the elimination of money bail and the elimination of bondsmen, but it never saw the light of day, Tom, and that's because they have so much influence there. And Common Cause, which speaks in the public interest and really takes issue with the private folks who are profiting, this is such a lucrative business.
So, Rachel, before we take a break, just about how much money are we talking about here in terms of the bail bonds industry supporting? I mean, I've heard estimates, you know, that are $280,000-something. Does that sound about right?
I can't speak to that one at the moment. I don't have the numbers in front of me. But I know that last year the bail bonds industry gave over $80,000 to Maryland lawmakers. And that includes, by the way, Governor Hogan, in addition to Senator Zirkin and Delegate Valerio, as Doug just mentioned.
All right. When we come back from break, we'll talk about who's for it, who's against it, why they may be for it or why they may be against it. And we'll continue our conversation about cash bail and other issues regarding criminal justice in the Maryland legislature. By the way, coming up tomorrow here on Midday, Dr. Lena Wen, the health commissioner of Baltimore, joins me for our regular Midday Health Watch. She'll get us up to date on what of most pressing concern in the arena of public health. She'll take your calls and emails and tweets tomorrow right here on Midday. We would be delighted to take your calls, emails, and tweets today as well. As we said, we're talking about what people can do if they've been issued a failure to appear warrant, and we're taking a look at what legislation is currently on the dockets of lawmakers in Annapolis concerning various issues around criminal justice, particularly bail reform. Doug Culbert is here. He's on the faculty of the University of Maryland Law School. He and his students are offering assistance to anybody who's missed a court date and who has been issued a failure to appear warrant. A special program to address that problem began earlier this month, and it's in effect for just one more day. Rachel Bay covers the General Assembly as part of the WIPR news team. You are welcome to call us when we come back, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So before we take that break, on Mondays, it's our practice here on Midday to acknowledge by name the people who have been killed in the city of Baltimore. So far this year, before this month of the year has even concluded, our city has already lost 32 people to homicide. 11 people were victims of homicide in Baltimore last week. They are Oscar Acevedo, age 24, Antonio Pesh, age 24, Michelle Mati, age 34, Sherman Johnson, age 59, Kelvin Armstead, age 34, Stephanie Hullahan, age 30, Linnell Reese, age 27, Marvin Odell, age 31, Raheem Payne, age 22, Aurelio Rios Rodriguez, age 26, and Dantia Atkins, who was 33 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking this afternoon about bail reform and other issues related to criminal justice with Professor Doug Culbert of the University of Maryland School of Law and Rachel Bay, who is WIPR's Statehouse reporter. What do you think about the cash bail system? Should that be altered in some way? Should it be eliminated? What's your take on what defendants should be required to do if they are accused of a crime? Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle is @MiddayTomHall. I want to listen to a little bit of Brian Frosch. He's the Attorney General of the state of Maryland. He's talking about his conversation and his opinion when he was asked to weigh in on whether or not bail reform was even constitutional.
We were asked by Delegate Learman and a number of others for our advice as to whether or not this was consistent with the Maryland and the United States constitutions, and we opined it likely is not. But in addition to the fact that it likely is not, it's terrible policy. It's terrible policy because it's ruinous for the people who are subjected to it.
So, Rachel Bay, when you talk about the various different approaches to how the reform, how the cash bail might be reformed, do you think there's consensus in the legislature that this really is, in fact, an unconstitutional thing and it's just got to be changed for that reason, if no other?
No, definitely not. I'd say Delegate Valerio, who chairs the Joe Valerio, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, is pretty resistant to the idea that bail can be removed entirely, that the system. I'm not sure. I haven't asked him directly if it's constitutional, to be fair, but I would say that he probably would not agree that it's completely unconstitutional.
Let's hear a little bit from Joe Valerio. He is a delegate from Prince George's County. This is one of the things he had to say about it recently.
With respect to the bail system, every case is different, every single case. We heard in there one case it was a pushing and a shoving. The guy can get 10 years for that. Okay, well, I mean, the judge is reading the statement of charges, and on that basis, it's going to be a lot different than somebody that's beaten up terribly and is in fear of harm. And they're only charged with second-degree assault. So each case is different. And I am not in favor of some agency making non-judicial determinations.
So, Doug Colbert, one of the distinctions that you and others have made is that for certain kinds of crimes, especially ones that are not violent, for lesser crimes, perhaps there is not such a need for this carrot and stick to a defendant to be sure that he or she shows up for court by charging them lots of money or costing them lots of money to a bail bond.
In my opinion, Tom, money should never decide freedom and it should never decide incarceration. So you shouldn't be in jail because you don't have $500, and you shouldn't get out of jail if you're a dangerous person if you have $100,000. From the bondsman's point of view, the cash register goes ting-a-ling every time a judge sets money bail because they get a 10% non-refundable fee. We're talking about the Able Foundation estimating between $100 million and $150 million collected in 2001. We're talking about a huge business, and that money does get spread around, Tom.
And if the cash bail system is done away with, all those businesses are out of business. That just doesn't exist anymore.
Well, and what we're saying is that if there is objective reason, and you can do a risk assessment. That's what the pretrial justice reformers have found in 11 different states and many cities. You can measure the probability of somebody committing a new crime or hurting somebody else. And so in most places, in D.C. and many states, you've got about 85 to 90% of the people being released, and you're holding on to the 10 or 15% who represent a danger. And that's why you should, what the Attorney General is saying is, if you're poor or low income and that's the only reason you're in jail, that will be subject to an unconstitutional finding eventually. This is the time right now for reform, but the resistance, and it comes every year, because I've been there since 1998, and I can tell you the power of the bondsman in Annapolis, their lobbyist walks in and calls everyone by their first name. It's a real palsy situation there.
Professor Doug Colbert from the University of Maryland School of Law joins me here in Studio A. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. We're also joined by Rachel Bay, who is WYPR's State House correspondent. Let's hear your opinion about the bail system, the cash bail system that is being that's having a look taken at in this session of the Maryland Assembly. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phone, Tim in Elkridge. Welcome to Midday with Rachel Bay and Doug Colbert.
Thank you, Tom. One thing I wanted to add in this cash business, because I personally knew a bail bondsman, it's a cash business and it passed money back. There is no real accountability or taxing on that in terms of the cash going flow. So besides, the corruption potential is very, very high. And now we're talking about the donations to the elected officials. So it really needs to be looked at. How do you hold accountability to the people in a cash, handling cash back and forth? And remember, there's criminal elements there because they're representing criminal elements. So it really is extremely high exposure to the influence of corruption, and that's what I just wanted to pass along to this, to the conversation.
Well, thanks for the call, Tim. I appreciate it. So, Rachel Bay, Bobby Zirkin, Senator Zirkin, has received, I guess, about $78,000 from the bail bonds industry. He says, of course, that that hasn't swayed his opinion one way or the other. Delegate Valerio has also received some money, and as you mentioned, so has Governor Hogan and Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford. Is there any talk about, you know, I haven't heard this, maybe you know, are people talking about at least regulating the bail bonds industry anymore? Is that part of the conversation, or are they just talking about sort of wiping out the system in general?
In general terms, I've heard a couple of snippets about regulating the industry, nothing specific at this point. I will add, though, that there's one proposal that was mentioned by the State Office of the Public Defender was to, in addition to eliminating the cash bail, to replace it with a, if you don't show up to court, you get fined concept, in which the fine would be levied by the government directly. So you would be eliminating the middleman of the bond, of the bail industry.
I mean, it is a very big industry. There's a lot of people involved in it. And obviously they have a, you know, an existential reason for opposing any reform. I do think it's been about $288,000 that has been given from the bond industry to Maryland lawmakers since 2011. So over the past, you know, 6 years or so. But again, Rachel Bay, I mean, we got to be clear that there's no, you know, reason necessarily to assume that there's a direct link between someone's position on a bill and money they might receive from lobbyists.
But right. The appearance, Tom, is very clear. I mean, when you're getting money, if somebody was paying you money to put on a particular show, if I gave you $1,000, that would be a lot. If I gave you $5,000 or $10,000, but now if we're giving $20,000 and $30,000, that's a huge amount of money. The bond industry is not regulated. So when people don't come to court, it's not like the state of Maryland is collecting the money from the bondsmen. The ABU reports that about 1% of the defendants who abscond, that money goes to the state. Plus, bondsmen have this power to arrest, Tom, this power to enter your home, which is much greater than police officers. It's really a vestige of the past.
And is the bond industry, you know, coming up with any suggestions for tweaks, you know, rather than just, you know, complete elimination of the cash bail system? Have you heard that these lobbyists are suggesting any particular bits and pieces of reforms that might be palatable to them?
Not yet. I imagine that as this moves forward in the legislature, and especially if these proposals do gain any sort of steam, that we will be hearing a lot from these from the industry.
Doug Colbert, we have a tweet from Zach who wants to know your thoughts about gun bail, which would allow inmates to turn in illegal guns in exchange for bail. You know anything about that?
I think it's always good to turn in guns. I'm much more in favor of turning in guns than having people arrested and staying in jail. But the idea here with bondsmen is that we're looking at a system where in Annapolis, Tom, they really don't have too much to worry about in terms of eliminating money bail, unless, of course, the public is outraged. If the public sees bail bondsmen as gaining this enormous profit from a system that really began with slavery in this country, where people who it's property that's being owned, and that's a really hard concept to wrap yourself around. But that's the relationship between the bonded defendant is property, the bondsman control property. They can arrest you. If I don't like the way you're looking at me right now, Mr. Hall, I can actually put you in central booking. I can enter your home at 5 a.m. I don't need warrants. So this is not happening in our neighborhoods. It's happening in the neighborhoods of the inner city, and it hits poor and low-income people the most.
Well, we're going to have to call it a day there. This final thought from Elizabeth, who sent us an email after the events of the last 10 days. What a relief it is to hear about an effort to make people's lives better rather than an effort to crush them. So thank you for that. Thank you, Elizabeth, and thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Doug Colbert. I appreciate it. Thanks to everybody who called. Rachel Bay covers the State House for WIPR. Doug Colbert is on the faculty of the Carey Law School at the University of Maryland. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen. Glenn, the health commissioner of Baltimore City. And by the way, looking ahead, later in the week, we'll speak with Dr. Sonia Santelises on Wednesday about personnel cuts in the Baltimore City school system. And on Friday, Senator Ben Cardin will join me for the hour to talk about the new administration and to take your calls and comments. That's all coming up this week on Midday. I'd like to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today for our guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends on the web, thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall for the entire Midday team. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.